So today we're joined by our very own Tiger Bay Board Member Adam Smith and local Politico celebrity Peter Schwartz. They'll engage in a recap of 2021 and what a year it has been. Adam, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Thanks for dressing up, Peter.
I'm inspired by the outfits of Mario Batali.
Jesse, we could be here. It's a little odd. Peter and I have been frenemies for a long time, and there was a time that I would have not been eager to be sitting next to this clown, but it's good to have. I am now a bureaucrat. I work for the City of Tampa. I'm the communications director for the City of Tampa. So I'm very likely to say something offensive today, and that's does not reflect anything that Jane Castor thinks or thinks. So I should get up. But now he's the I'm no longer a journalist. He's a journalist, more or less. So it's
less, definitely less.
I think our format, I'll give it to you, but our format is basically, I think we'll ask each other a few questions, unrehearsed questions, and then take it from you.
You're right, Adam. There were times, is that working?
There were definitely times when you would actually block me from, you would not appear on like radio shows, or like they would call, like Rob Lowry would call Adam. It's like, yeah, we're gonna do Florida This Week, and it's me, or it's Wendy March, you, Renee Flowers, and I think we're gonna invite Shorshan. And Adam would conveniently, yeah, I think I've got something to do that day, or, and so I would wonder, I'm like, why am I never on? But actually, to Adam's credit, that's only because I love Adam. Adam actually went to our wedding. Adam is cosmopolitan in a sense of, he lived in New York, is well educated. He's a beautiful writer. I remember two pieces by Adam, specifically his profile of Charlie Crist in 2014 with Michael Cruz, that he did was illuminating to me, and that's somebody who thought he knew everything about Charlie, but some of the details that Adam had about a messed up hotel room down in South America and ashes ground into the carpet, stuff like that, was just incredible writing. And then also Adam's, I think his profiles of Devron Gibbons and Scott Wagman in 2009. I know this is like ancient history, but as we just got out of a mayoral race, I was yearning for that kind of color commentary about the candidates, and his description of Devron Gibbons at that time, I think it was something like an ambitious man in an ill-fitting suit. I don't think Devron's ever outrun that description, quite honestly. And so I've always, like, Adam's instincts, yes, he's a journalist, and I think actually, like, when you hear all the fake news stuff, Adam is pretty center in the sense that he won't buy into the, well, shouldn't we get rid of Ron DeSantis? He's like, no, I think Ron DeSantis is probably going to win, or something like that. He's very, like, I would run my thoughts against Adams, because I thought his temperature taking of what was really going on in the local community, the state community, was usually right, even if I didn't want to hear it. So I thought Adam had always done a really good job at that. And yes, I am a journalist. That's why I wore my FloridaPolitics.com vest in honor of Glenn Youmkin of Virginia. These are available on our website in case you are looking for some holiday presents. Everybody in your family, I'm sure, would love a FloridaPolitics.com tactical vest.
This is where I'm supposed to say really nice things about you, too.
No.
He does a good job. Let's get started.
Okay.
Probably the biggest, correct me if I'm wrong, but probably the biggest race Pinellas County has looming is the congressional race to unseat Charlie Crist. Unpredictable primary, two pretty unpredictable primaries. Just give me your basic thoughts there.
And you told them like the format, we're going to do like a three question of each ask me anything format. Adam's question was not ask me anything, but like we're not going to be, you know, a-holes to each other, but that's the idea is we're going to be,
maybe.
We'll see how the last question goes. So redistricting is happening right now, long story short. The legislature meets in January. There are maps out from the Senate and the House side. The Senate has a map that like that Democrats did not squawk about, and that got like a B from some of the nonpartisan groups, like in terms of not gerrymandering. The Florida House, in very Florida House style, does not have a map that doesn't gerrymander, and so the big issue of redistricting is an age-old question in Tampa Bay politics. Should the congressional district of 13, the Charlie Crist district, the Bill Young district, should it be all Pinellas and pick up the black part of Pinellas County and therefore make it a Democratic lean seat? Or do you jump Tampa Bay and put the two white parts of South Tampa, I call that the douchier part of the district, and Northeast St. Pete together, and then carve out the black part of South Pinellas, attach it to other black parts of Hillsborough and Manatee, and basically and create this Democratic leaning seat, but make then the Charlie Crist seat more of a Republican leaning seat. And so that's the big dilemma right now. The problem is that we're governed by fair districts, which was the amendment that got passed that says that you can't like take into consideration political differences, et cetera. The problem is it specifically puts conflicting guidelines at work against each other. It says you can't divide cities up, you can't divide like community, so-called communities of interest, but it also says you cannot regress in terms of minority representation. So even if you want to try and keep St. Pete together, you can't do that at the expense of black voters. But if you want to keep the black voters together, you really can't do that at the expense of so-called communities of interest. And so the legislators do have a difficult job interpreting that. That brings us to CD 13, which is the Charlie Crist district. It will be the most fascinating congressional race probably in the country. It's probably one of the very few congressional races in this era where you don't have competitive congressional districts anymore, where you will have competitive primaries on both sides.
So let me, that was a very long wind up. But so let's just go through the primaries here, because regardless of how that district winds up, you're going to have primaries. So the Republican primary, I'm going to forget the lesser known candidates, but you have Paula, what's her name? Anna Paula Luna.
Man, you were out.
But she's a hardcore. Trump's endorsed her. She's a far right.
Anna Paulina Luna.
And thank you. She was the nominee last time.
Yes.
Did quite well against Charlie Crist in a very Republican district. And then you've got the sort of more mainstream
Amanda
establishment
Mackey.
Republican Amanda Mackey, who's getting a lot of Republican endorsements. My theory is that this is the party of Trump. And no matter how many endorsements she gets, Luna still wins.
And you also have Audrey Henson, I think is her name, who, and this is totally objectifying and sexist, so I hope it's not being taped. Just kidding. There's like this competition amongst the Republican women to see who can wear like the thinnest brassiere like top while holding an automatic weapon. Like if you look at like all of their like promotional materials, they're all like they're literally like that's Anna Paulina Luna, I think, modeled for Maxim. And like it's kind of like you've seen like Amanda Mackey take the same, like she somehow has like decided that she's gonna Anna Paulina Luna it up. And then Henson, who's a DC player, is also kind of like she's doing this like walk and talk video, and it's very this is not Sandy Merman territory, like these young women that are running there. So I agree with you. I think that, in fact, St. Pete Polls, Matt Floral's operation that we commission with that is always right about Pinellas politics, shows that it's Anna Paulina Luna's race to lose, although Mackey does seem to be getting...
She's a good candidate.
I mean, she's a strong candidate, but in normal times, if this were not the era of Trump, she'd be a shoo-in for Pinellas.
This guy wins like one or two races, and now he can tell when everybody's a good candidate. I mean, look at this guy. He's 2%.
She fits the profile. On the Democratic side,
yeah.
You've got Ben Diamond.
Ben Diamond.
Well-known. Eric Lynn, run before.
You like Eric.
A lot of money. And you've got Michelle Rayner, who's a terrific, who's a force of nature. Has not raised a ton of money. How do you see that?
So I will say, like, don't sleep on Michelle Rayner. Like, she could actually, if she gets out of the primary, she could win because she's so, she has the strongest personality, I think, of those six people. You know, it is a matter of whether or not there are enough black Democrat voters drawn into that seat, whether or not, you know, her base is part of it, or if she is just, you know, I don't think that she's going to win if the seat is Palm Harbor centric, but if it's got a lot of St. Pete in it, I think she's got a better shot. You know, Ben Diamond, we all live, who doesn't like Ben Diamond? I mean, Ben Diamond's like
Eric Lynn.
I mean, Ben Diamond is a sweetheart. I mean, he literally is like, you know, when they say the nice Jewish kid from down the street, Ben Diamond is the nice Jewish kid from down the street. But I think to win a congressional race in today's modern era, he's going to have to bare his fangs a little bit and get some sharper elbows. Otherwise, like, Eric Lynn's going to spend a lot of money. Michelle Rayner's going to be able to work the ground. Like, there is no Tampa Bay Times that's going to come in and save Ben, you know, and say we need to have the nice guy win. And then when he gets to the Republican level, Kevin McCarthy and all those mother up in D.C., they are going to knife Ben Diamond for every bad vote that he's taken in Tallahassee. And they might be, if Anna Paulina Luna can get within 7% of Charlie Crist, I think she can absolutely beat dare I say, milk toasty Ben Diamond. So he's going to have to, you know, pull those elbows out and get a lot sharper.
I think Ben is the front runner there. Your turn.
I think, all right, so let's put on the journalism. Who was the most fascinating political candidate of, let's just say, like, the last decade? I don't want to go too far back. But who was the most fascinating to interview repeatedly, not just the one-off like that, but who was your, like, most fascinating politician, local politician, that you like to interview? Why? Give us an anecdote about maybe a little behind the scenes on something like that.
That's a good question and a tough question, because there are about six different Charlie Crists over the years. So all of them were variously interesting. I think for somebody that's been around Florida politics a long time, Charlie Crist is interesting just because he's just been so many different things and often successful. I used to say when I was a reporter and I would be in Tallahassee that, you know, they have these gaggles, you know, the governor will go and do a little event, and then there's a few minutes where the reporters gather around them and ask questions. You know, there was, if you missed a gaggle with Jeb Bush, this is how old I am, you were very worried, because he could have, and Jeb Bush just winging it off the top of his head, could have given you 10 really good stories, just because he was an ideas guy who was throwing things out. If you missed something with Charlie Crist, no, nothing. If you missed something, what do you think, Adam? If you missed something with Rick Scott, nothing.
Right.
He never said anything. And Ron DeSantis,
I don't think he's had a press gaggle.
I think he would just give you the finger and move on. That way, I think Marco Rubio was in many ways. There have been about four different versions of Marco Rubio, too. But I guess I'd have to say Charlie.
Who was your question 1B? Who was a tough local interview? Like, I know there's people like Rick Scott that are kind of robotic that you're not going to get something from. But who was somebody that would push back? You know, Charlie's not pushing back. He's not going to, you know, go back and forth with you. But, like, when you called up to get answers about something, who was, like, a tougher interview that you...
Okay, this is just a random, this is not local, but I remember when I first started as the political editor, Janet Reno was just getting into the race. I was telling my kids about this over Thanksgiving break. I don't know why she came up, but she was getting in the race for governor. And at the time, the Tampa Bay Times, Bill Gailey was the editorial board, he just had it in his mind. That was sort of conventional wisdom among moderate Democrats that Janet Reno would never win. Bill McBride was the great hope of the Democratic Party that he would beat. And so there were, I think, Martin Dykeman, who was no centrist. He and Gailey wrote some really brutal articles about Janet Reno. And they were just gunning for her, kind of. And one of the first stories I wanted to do about Janet Reno, I hadn't met her yet. She was just early on in the race. Was she was Attorney General when 9/11 happened. So I was going to write something about how vulnerable was that going to make her. You know, the FBI reports the Attorney General. Isn't that something she's going to face tough questions on? So I went down to, that's when they had money and they'd send you down to, South Florida. And I have never, she was the nastiest person. She basically, that's a stupid question. And would not answer, gave me these one word answers. It was frankly terrifying for a young reporter. And you know, she's twice my height too. And she wouldn't cooperate. She just said, I'm not gonna talk to you. And so then she had several events and they were not on a public schedule. So I ended up stalking her. Somehow, somebody, I don't even remember how, I did find out where she was going to these fundraisers, and I kept, I just stalked her, like a creepy stalker. And finally, after like the fourth time, she just said, okay. And she sat down with me and sort of said something to the effect of, you know, you are persevering, aggressive or something like that. And I think of all the politicians I've ever met in my life, Janet Reno was a true original person. I mean, she was really this creature from the Everglades. She lived in literally lived in this shack without air conditioning, with partridges or peacocks roaming around. She was like sort of in a Lawton Childs, you know, where back when people really were being eccentric and nuts.
The bottom line there is that the line between good reporter and creepy stalker is a thin one.
Well, I'll give you, just without getting out on a tangent, now I work in communications, so I work, you know, I fend off the press sometimes and try to work with the press. I've got there's a reporter who is consistently interviewing people, police officers in Tampa, and the PIO there has said, you know, no, go through me. And this reporter insists, no, I'm not going to go. She keeps doing it anyway. And they were going to write a letter to the editor, and I said, you know, there's no way does an editor want to, is an editor going to scold a reporter for not listening to a PIO about talking? So all you're going to do is get her a raise, if that's what you're going to do. My question.
Your question.
Local, do you think, let's just put our crystal ball, could the community in Tampa Bay accept a split season, and where do you see the Rays winding up?
Good question. So I'm, not surprisingly, I have a, give us back our property down there. Just give us back those 80 acres. I mean, they are, Stu Strumberg and the team are the best baseball minds. They are the worst political minds, I think, in Tampa Bay. Like, of all the major sports organizations in Florida, they are like the ones that don't have any Tallahassee lobbying representation. Like, everybody up in Tallahassee puts somebody on retainer just so you get, like, the Corcoran, Richard Corcoran's brother's lobbying firm represents the Tampa Bay Bucks. You do that just so you can get intel and, like, run your ideas. And I remember, I'm trying to think about who's in this room that maybe was part of that, but, you know, we beat the Rays when they wanted to move the stadium over there with $40,000 against their $1 million operation, with the, you know, keeping them from, when we, you know, they wanted to move the whole operation over to Al Lang. They're really bad at politics.
Who's we? You work for somebody?
Hal Friedman and that group. It was just after I got back. We did the petition drive. You know, don't spend $1 billion to move 16 blocks. And so that, and they, we ended up, I think that was 2009, and they ended up backing off of that proposal. You know, because of, it was like Peter Belmont, you know, for anybody that remember or that knows Peter, Peter Belmont, Hal Friedman and Willie, some of the like local environmental, Darden was involved in that. So, you know, I will say with this, it's crazy that they want to, you know, they want to give up and move away from the hottest 80 acres in the Southeast's real estate market. Like, other than maybe Miami Beach, there is no better. I mean, Barclay and I were just talking about it. Like, you can't get a lease on a one bedroom down there. But they're saying, hey, you know what would be really great? Montreal. And that is just so crazy to me that they want to leave. And so I'm just like, hey, get rid of it. Take Derby Lane, you know, and move that down there as a sports book down there. Turn that into a little casino down there or whatever, and redevelop that. Can it work split? I think one of the things, and this is the Noah Pransky, if you guys remember Noah, he has a great blog still, he writes for NBC. He was kind of the first person. I think you got to realize the economics of baseball. The economics of the Tampa Bay Rays, they only exist so that the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees can play away games. And that they have, that's the only reason why they exist. It's because,
does that mean he's at his limit?
No, we have five more.
Oh,
darn it. The Yes Network, the Yankee Sports Network, makes more money than there's ever going to be that you could get to pay for the Rays and all the stadium. They should, in fact, the Yankee Sports Network should build the stadium down here because that's where they get it from, the advertising dollars paid to a 10 million person TV market up there. All the Rays need is a studio. They don't need a stadium, and that's all they. And the whole idea of us filling up 35,000 seats—that's from a bygone era. That's never going to exist. So if Tampa and company want to put a stadium over there in Ybor, let them have at it. But just don't use our public dollars to do so.
I don't want to get another 10-minute answer, but you didn't answer the question. Do you think the community can support a half season?
I think, yes, I think people have sort of come around. Initially, it was a
I think it's a novel idea where it would be like, I don't think anybody cares anymore. It doesn't matter if people don't show up. They're not showing up anyways, but they will watch them on television.
And if a casino is coming to Tropicana Field, I'm picketing.
Why?
Yeah, because that's the last.
In fact, my presentation today is brought to you by the new Car Rock Sports app, where you can go on right now, still legal in Florida, and put a little action right now.
See, that's the new journalism that we can talk about.
I'm kind of serious. That the best local.
Hold on, I'm just gonna put a little action down in case anybody wants to get in on. You know, trending now. American versus Stony Brook. I can do that right now. I can bet on that if anybody. Go ahead, Adam. You continue.
The best local political coverage is provided by Florida Politics. Because the Tampa Bay
Times
doesn't do a lot anymore. But Florida Politics basically makes its money from interest groups, largely, right?
Yeah.
So how much should the public out there be worried about when they're reading something there? Is it, you know, is this brought to you by Ballard lobbyists or Southern Strategy lobbyists, or how much does that shape what you do?
Well, so this answer is provided to you and powered by Florida Power and Light, powering all of Southeast Florida. They should worry intensely, and I welcome them to worry. Like, and if anybody has a question, then they should ask those questions. Just as they should ask, I mean, the largest stakeholder of the New York Times is a Mexican cell phone operator named Carlos Slim. You know, I want to see the next time they write an article about narco-terrorism, whether or not they disclose that. I mean, Jeff Bezos, I mean, it's the Bezos Post at this point. They're providing an incredible job, but, and those questions should come up and we should talk about them. But just on our little operation, I'll say a couple things to defend it. We've had enough reporters who have left, who have gone on to other things, that if there were some sort of like, hey, Shorsh puts his thumb on the scale, I think that would have come up. I think like the Tampa Bay Times would have said, like my friend Christine Sexton, who is a reporter, probably the best healthcare reporter in Florida. We just brought her back, but she worked for Politico for years. She had all the opportunity in the world to, you know, say, you know what, sure, she's got ads on there from the Florida Medical Association. And anytime I tried to write about the Florida Medical Association, I had to run it by it. And the reality is that has not happened. I will say it's probably the reverse of it. I feel like Michael Corleone in Godfather 3, where he says, you know, we've gotten rid of the casinos, you know, and he's begging for the money. Like, we have, in fact, we had Stephen Brill's group, NewsGuard. They put up like the check mark whether or not you're accurate or not. And it's a little app you can add to your web browser, and you should add it. So that way you kind of, it gives you a sense of ownership and where their revenue is on all of it. And they were asking me, we had gotten a check mark before, very narrowly. Like, we got a gentleman's seat, basically, and got through. And then, like, they just reviewed us again, like, 2 years later. Because I had always done political consulting. I'd worked, you know, I'd done stuff for Jeff Brandis, and I'd done stuff for hospitals and things like that, and offered strategic advice. And now, you know, I would say 98% of our revenue is, you know, just straight advertising at one level or another. Now, the advertising's different than what you're used to. It's more, hey, the 25 most powerful politicians list that comes out in February, it's brought to you by the Southern Group. But that just makes me an entrepreneur, I mean, as far as I'm concerned. It's clearly shown, et cetera. But now at this point, I mean, I think it's kind of ridiculous that I exist. I think that it's ridiculous that the Times and other people have ceded all of this ground to us, where, I mean, I know that a lot of you don't know this now, but I'll give you two things really quick, because I know you like long answers. You know, we have a $2.5 million payroll. That's insane. Like, that, when you think about the fact that I was the guy, you know, blogging from my mom's house 10 years ago, the fact that we have a $2.5 million reporter payroll. We have the largest reporting footprint in the state, 19 reporters. Second of all, we just started Florida Politics Plus about 6 months ago. We now supply the news that you read on Bay News 9, Spectrum 13, on the business journals chains, all four of them. Creative Loafing, open up a Creative Loafing or go to their site. You'll see that the most of their political reporting is from floridapolitics.com. Go look at the Tampa Bay Times today. The editorial cartoons are from my people. And so it's kind of crazy that this, you know, local blogger has eschewed all this other stuff, you know, whereas everybody's being bought out by hedge funds and things like that. I really am trying to provide a good product and a public service in terms of journalism.
Just need an editor when you answer questions. Should we go to these?
I didn't get, I asked you one question.
All right, I'll be quick.
Now, if you're gonna be like that, no. I'll hold it, we'll go to there and then we'll do a close question. That way it's,
Anne?
You gotta put on a little bit of a show.
Good afternoon, Anne Drinking-Mullen with Doyle Wealth Management. Adam, the question goes to you. The question is, frankly, are facts in journalism dead? Where do we find facts? Where do I go? If I go to Fox News, if I go to MSNBC or CNN, there's a nugget of fact, and I feel like they're warped. Where's the reality? Where's facts? Where do I go to get the truth?
Well, I don't have a good answer. I mean, no, obviously facts are not dead. Facts exist. They're objective facts. But the problem is you have 40% of the population almost that doesn't sometimes accept objective facts. And you have some very popular networks that are often just, you know, I'm Tucker Carlson does not peddle in facts. He peddles in ratings and anger and bitterness, and I'm sorry. So I think facts are vulnerable.
I mean, I'll offer 2 cents on it, or maybe $2 worth, you know, given, but I think you're finding facts, and I think it's a golden age for journalism right now. I think what is happening, you know, where you look at the expansion of the Washington Post, you look at the expansion of the New York Times, I think there's more journalism out there than you all know what to do with. You know, like, you look at, like, ProPublica and what they do, and you look at, you know, yes, the newspaper is declining. Like, so take Tampa Bay. The Tampa Bay Times has shrunk. Yes, I get that. But the other, like, outlets that are there, like, the St. Pete Catalyst does a good job covering local events. the St. Pete Catalyst. There's a lot of online, like Axios Tampa Bay does a fun job, covering stuff. Who here, quite honestly, who here subscribes to Axios Tampa Bay? Axios is a huge player in DC right now. Mike Allen is probably, is still probably the gold standard for, newsletters and things like that. I think that there's a lot more good journalism out there than maybe we realize. The facts are definitely out there, and it's maybe we're not listening to it, or we're, it's so much that, when ProPublica comes out with a 18,000 word expose on lead smelting or whatever, we're still voting on, Dancing with the Stars and not paying attention.
It's people believing them. It's not so much, is the journalism out there? Is it trusted?
State Senate candidate, Berkeley
Harlow. I'm not.
See, he's not even going to deny it.
So I read The Economist, and the foreign politician I'm about the most is Marco Rubio. Usually when it comes to foreign policy stuff. Where does he go from here? It's fascinating to me. He's recovered from the Stockholm Syndrome of Trump, right? And now he's essentially free to do stay in the Senate for 80,000 years. Where does he go? What does he do?
I don't think he has recovered from the Stockholm Syndrome with Trump, because like so many Republicans who will, behind the scenes tell you that he thinks Trump is dangerous and a clown and all the things he said when he was running against him for the nomination, he will not cross him publicly because they fear what that could mean to him. So I think Marco Rubio was hoping for the Trump fever to die down and then a mainstream, but he's damaged with a lot of the base in a way that really surprised me. But
I don't think Marco goes anywhere. I think that there's always this inclination to like dream up US senators as presidents and to dream up US representatives as senators and state senators as congressmen. And you're always like trying to push, them to the next thing. I think Rubio took a bite at the presidency. Obviously that did not work out for him, and I think he is exactly what the U.S. Senate is right now. I think he's probably just coming into his own in the U.S. Senate, getting a little bit of seniority. I would imagine the Republicans are probably going to be in the majority here in 2022. I think he likes to weigh in on the foreign policy things. He's kind of the Deputy Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs under a Republican president. He likes putting out the press releases about Venezuela and Castro and Cuba, et cetera. So I think Marco is perfectly situated where he wants to be. I think the one thing that he will, the only thing that would change for him, and I think you saw this kind of with, is it Tim or Tom DeMint? Jim DeMint. Marco doesn't have any money. I mean, Marco is as, broke as, yesterday. He doesn't have any money. And increasingly in DC, the people that are in the Senate, from Rick Scott on down, there are nine zeros in their bank accounts. And, Marco just can't play at that level. So I would not be surprised if the only thing that I would say, the thing that would take Marco out even more so than a presidential run, because he's not going to go up against DeSantis, et cetera, is somebody coming along and offering him $10 million a year to be executive vice president of the Heritage Foundation or something, or the Koch Network or something, where he can do something like that. He's got like four kids that are almost.
I think he's going to always be on a VP and a Secretary of State shortlist for any Republican.
Well, Wendy Grassi, is there any chance Val Demings could defeat him?
Yes. I don't think it's always likely. I think Florida, we probably agree, is turning more and more Republican, but it's not overwhelming Republican. Val Demings is a super candidate in a lot of ways, and Marco's just not as beloved by the base as he once was.
So I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it, but I think Democrats have a very good candidate against Marco Rubio.
I will quote the great philosopher Harvey Dent from Batman, who said, "It is always darkest before the dawn," and I think that that's where the Democrats are right now. I think that they there is a path. Again, I think it's like Adam just said, it's probably a 5-to-1 chance. Like if you look at the prediction markets right now, where you can invest genuine money into where the races are coming out, it's about 70 cents for Rubio, maybe 30 cents for Demings. There is a path, and I think it's the only path. If Chris gets the nomination as governor, and Demings and him can run Florida like Ossoff and Warnock ran in Georgia as a genuine tandem, and that Chris doesn't have to worry about turning out black vote, and Demings can take care of the money, because Charlie's not going to have any money. And obviously, I mean, just isn't. And if he has to spend money to turn out minority votes, he's going to have even less money. But if they can run as a combo, that may be their only shot at beating. I know you guys are going to ask about DeSantis. I think, and I keep saying this about Charlie, I think the only way you beat DeSantis is, and it's horrible, is to do what you're doing now, which is let DeSantis punch himself out. Be as horrible as he is. Nikki Freed took the wrong approach, trying to punch and go pound for pound with DeSantis. She doesn't have the operation, the wherewithal, the money, etc. You have to let DeSantis be as mean, indifferent, lack of empathy, etc., that you get to October and you do see a contrast where, hey, you've got this guy who almost feels like he's not even human. Like he's never acknowledged the fact that 62,000 Floridians have died from coronavirus. Even if you like him, he's never done that. And then you present the most overly caring, feeling, empathetic, Clintonian politician in the world, Charlie Crist, who may be light on policy and has all the baggage, and at least he presents a little bit of a contrast, and then Val Demings jacks up black turnout to like Gillum level 98%. That's the only way, and even at that, it's 5-to-1 against.
I think it's more better than 5-to-1 against, 3-to-1 against. But I also think if we're having 50 to 60,000 cases of COVID every day and Joe Biden is at 40-something percent approval, it's going to be a brutal year for all Democrats.
Yeah.
Hey, Bias, do you think Trump or any of the Trumps will get involved in Florida politics?
I mean, they are. You know, Trump endorsed Wilt Simpson early on. I will say this, my answer to this, which is my favorite, is the most interesting dynamic, I think, in all of politics is Trump versus DeSantis. And it reminds me of the genuine philosophical argument that happened between Sulla and Pompey in Rome. And Pompey said to Sulla, who had conquered, he said, more men worship the rising sun than the setting. And that is where DeSantis is. And all of you, my Republican friends, who get to vote in primaries are going to have to face a decision. Will you vote for DeSantis to keep out Trump? All my Democratic friends are going to have to decide. Will you vote for DeSantis and support DeSantis so as to keep away an anti-democratic Trump? And that is the big internal philosophical argument. Like if you go on the Bulwark and the Never Trumpers and those folks, that's the argument that they're saying right now. And that's why they're moving to DeSantis. It's not so much that they love Ron DeSantis, because Ron DeSantis, you wrote the best profile ever on DeSantis on how like he would walk around basically in the Capitol like by himself, right?
He's not.
He doesn't have a lot of good friends.
And so I think that they're only going to embrace him if it means keeping out Trump. But go ahead.
Who's next?
Renee.
Right here, actually.
Oh, sorry.
Kelly Kirshner, fast forward 4 years. What does a wildly successful Ken Welch administration look like? What does a middle of the road 4 years look like that makes him vulnerable? And what does success not look like?
That's a great question. A wildly successful Ken Welch will be somebody who's got four years?
Yeah.
God, where will Tropicana Field be in then? Where nobody's worrying about the Rays anymore, that's resolved, and there's some great project there that is everybody's excited about, it isn't causing dissension, and we're seeing some progress in affordable housing, and it feels like something new. We have our first black mayor, and it feels like every part of the community is being heard and is getting something. I don't mean getting something, that's a weird thing to say, but is feeling good about how their city is serving.
Kent just needs to stay out of the way in a lot of ways. Like, you know, like St. Pete has succeeded, like it succeeded under Foster, you know, who was not a very great mayor because of the dynamics. Geography is destiny. I mean, it's the city should be great. I think that everybody, most of the people in this room and elected officials, our number one job is to make sure St. Pete doesn't turn into Miami Beach. That St. Pete doesn't turn into one of these cheesy other communities where the growth is so much. We get so attracted to the new money people that come in. Your former client, the Katsimatises, and all these guys that come in and like, oh, I'm going to do a 90-story tower and I'm going to put it right here. And you're like, no, I don't know about that. Like, that doesn't fit inside, you know, beautiful St. Pete. As I travel a little bit again, I find that people know where St. Pete is. I think that that's a lot to do with Tom Brady. I really do. I think he's the best ambassador for Tampa Bay, that more people know that where we are than ever before. But I think our number one job is to keep St. Pete from that. I think another issue, I think we still have really lingering racial and generational poverty issues in South St. Petersburg that can, if he does nothing on them, they will never get done. If the first black mayor does not do something to lift South St. Petersburg up with all of the rest of us, like, well, while everybody else is doing great over here, to continue to have South St. Petersburg struggle behind is not only unfair, it's wrong, it's a missed opportunity. That will be, you want to say, like, what will a middle of the road Ken Welch? I would be disappointed if something is not done. And I'm not saying we have to do like the whole like drop $100 million in there again and build some of the stuff, but can we expand the pie, you know, beyond, I don't know, maybe like 13th Avenue South? Can it get down to 22nd? Can it get, you know, we're always going to have tough parts in any big city, but can we get even a little bit? Otherwise, a big developer, Taylor Morrison or something, is going to come in and say, wait a second, there are 1,000 $100,000 houses three blocks from the water in one of the best cities. Yes, they're occupied by black people, but maybe I, not that that's bad, but I'm saying that the issue will be, can they just go and give every one of those people $200,000 and then you gentrify the entire area? And I think that that is a very genuine threat, the gentrification of middle South St. Petersburg going into the next decade.
That's why it's the core part of the Harlem State Senate.
Speaking of lifting up South St. Petersburg, South St. Petersburg's shining angel of redemption, the American Standard Bearer.
In light of DeSantis advertising for law enforcement to come in from all other states and not really checking backgrounds, and we saw that three of those that he honored have some really critical concerns, do you think that that is intentional based on some of the legislation that has been passed recently related to those individuals like Black Lives Matter organizations who protest, and the legislation around protesting, and if that is being done to agitate African Americans to aid in his push for governor and then later in the presidency?
I'll give you two answers to that. I think number one of the most important trends to watch, like I think Florida's actually more red than we realize, that I think much in the way that St. Petersburg became more blue than we realized, we had two Southern Baptist non-dancing mayors, and then all of a sudden we elected Rick Kreisman. And that happened inside of 10 years. The data switched so quickly. I think Florida is that same way, where if you are some aggrieved white person living in Staten Island or Youngstown or wherever, you're just like, man, I can't afford to live here. Where am I going to live? Well, let's go down to Fort Myers. And I think that there are thousands of those people, genuinely. That's why I think you've seen the voter registration numbers go the way that they have gone. Yes, that has more to do with Democrats dropping into the inactive status. But there's a lot of those kind of people. I don't think that it is like, hey, let's attract cops because we don't like Black Lives Matter. Not that that's what you're saying.
But I do think that there is a, and it's the first time, you guys got to go watch the video from on Monday, Ron DeSantis. He's standing in front of the highway patrol. He loves to stand in front of highway patrol guys. I mean, it's like he's out of the 1970s Alabama. He brings up the word. He says anti-white. It's the first time he's actually used that term. I just saw it as this man. His wife is sick with breast cancer, for those of you who may not know. He's got three beautiful children, and he's coming down out of Thanksgiving. I don't know about you, but I came out of Thanksgiving, and I wanted to talk to people about, man, I had a great time in Deer Valley. I had some great turkey, a lot of great turkey, actually, as you can tell. And I'm ready for the holidays. This guy is like, hey, we got to crack some skulls because Kyle Rittenhouse, who nobody cares about in this state, was destroyed by the media from 2 weeks ago. I don't say this lightly. I think that Ron DeSantis was psychologically impacted by the isolation of coronavirus being in the governor's mansion. I think he is a much, and everybody I talk to that is close to him, every single person that says the same thing, that something happened to him last summer. I'm not saying he's not a successful politician, but he's a much meaner, more indifferent person. And I think he likes the idea, like kind of the way Grady Judd talks, like where it's like, oh, we're going to, if we see a person out there, we're going to shoot first and then shoot again. You're like, Jesus Christ, like have some decency. I think Ron DeSantis loves that kind of stuff.
I wish that, the trick with Ron DeSantis is he doesn't just appeal to the Republican base, which every, the Democrats appeal to their base. He appeals to the most extreme part of the base. He appeals to about 25% of the base, and that's every message he does is about that. And so, yeah, he's going to bring up the people that think Fox is too liberal are the people he's trying to reach.
It is.
Everything he does and says, and it's working so far.
Yeah, we have time for one more question.
Vini Osiasen. I channel surf the news, so I don't see all of what channel, but I have noticed on Fox News that they do a lot about DeSantis and a lot about Florida, promoting Florida, and I'm wondering, are they trying to set him up as an alternative to Trump to save their reputation, and how much influence do they have on the Trump right?
I think the answer is DeSantis is sort of a darling. I'm not sure if I misunderstood. I don't think you're thinking DeSantis would challenge Trump, because I think that's a non-starter. But DeSantis is beloved by the Trump Republican Party, and so he's a ratings draw. And he is a very smart guy with the media, so he has been, you know, they keep in very, very close touch with the producers, and he's always accessible. I remember when I first met him, back when he was first being talked about to run for governor, you know, he did about four hits on Fox News in one day. And so he is, that's his bread and butter.
I don't know if you watched the show Succession on HBO. I think that's the situation they're facing right now, where the family that controls Fox, you know, Rupert Murdoch just turned 90. You know, he made some comments that that Trump needed to move on. I think that there is an internal divide. I don't think Fox News knows what it wants to do. I think that's why you saw some people recently resign. They have purged any of the never Trumper folks in there. Tucker Carlson is a nativist that is, he's beyond popular. I mean, they're in the business of selling ads and viewers, and their viewers want to hear about how, you know, the darkies are coming across the Mexican border, and it's disgusting. And it just, there's no balancing out of that. I do think that they want to balance out with DeSantis. I do think, again, it's the existential question that all Republicans are facing right now. Would you take DeSantis and all of his authoritarianism almost, if it meant keeping out an anti-democratic Donald Trump? I mean, I'm a registered Republican, and it's a question that I've got to face right now. Do I want to support DeSantis over Trump? I don't think that you get a January 6th with Ron DeSantis, and so if that's where the decision ends up going, I'm sure Fox News is facing the same decision. It's none of those other tomato cans. I mean, look at, what did Chris Christie sell 2,300 books last week? I mean, what a joke. I mean, the person that has the fifth best odds of becoming president right now, it's Trump, Biden, Kamala,
DeSantis. Number five is Nikki Haley. We all know right now, all the money in all of our pockets, there is no way Nikki Haley or who is the Secretary of State, Pompeo, none of those folks are going to become president. It is Trump, Biden, DeSantis, or else. And that's what we're coming down to.
All right. That concludes our program. Please join me in thanking.